is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The poor performance was to be expected. The students did not complete the syllabus because they only learned for 1 year and only one term when they were in grade 7 because of the lockdown and closure of schools. Without the effort that teachers made, the performance could even have been very low.
That's Takava Firazu of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe on standardized test scores by 7th graders showing 88 schools with zero passing mark. Details coming up also. The African Union Disease Control Body says despite its limits, it is not walking away from AstraZeneca vaccine. And 28 UN peacekeepers from Togo were attacked in central Mali, and all these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. President Donald Trump broke with decades of U.S. foreign policy and recognized Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. That came as Morocco agreed to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, becoming the fourth Arab nation to do so in recent months as part of what have been called the Abraham Accords. Now, new President Joe Biden's administration faces a foreign policy issue on whether to reverse Trump's decision on Western Sahara. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Chenawi spoke with Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, about the different scenarios and whether Morocco is prepared for U.S. reversal of Trump's recognition.
I think that Morocco would be prepared to deal with it if it happened, but I don't think Morocco is expecting that result, primarily because an overt reversal would create a lot of friction, not only with Morocco, but with Israel, most likely, because the recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara was a key part of the quid pro quo of the partial normalization of Morocco with Israel. And while that merely formalizes a relationship that has actually existed for decades, nevertheless, that was not an easy decision for Morocco to break with most of the rest of the Arab world. So there had to be something very substantial for them to formalize the sort of economic and other relations that they've had covertly for decades with Israel. And I also would say that the Biden administration is facing many other higher priority issues of foreign policy than really dealing with the Trump's administration's recognition of the Western Sahara's Moroccan sovereign territory.
But during Secretary of State Tony Blinken's first news conference last week at the State Department, he was asked about the Abraham Accords and the Western Sahara. He answered the first question saying, "We very much support the Abraham Accords. We think that Israel normalizing relations with its neighbors and other countries in the region is a very positive development." However, he elected to stay well clear of the Western Sahara question. How would you explain that?
I see a clear return to proper diplomacy here. What we have was Secretary Blinken stating that the Biden administration is basically reviewing the situation now. That those were almost verbatim the words he said. Because both President Biden and Secretary Blinken are very, very experienced in foreign policy issues, unlike the previous administration, what this brings to my mind is that the administration now will undergo methodical review of all of the factors that come into play with a contemplation of reversal of the recognition. So maybe one of the biggest is the return of diplomacy in U.S. overall foreign policy. That was key to both Biden's first foreign policy speech at the Department of State this past week, and also Blinken's first speech after he took his office. So I also think that the need to regain America's moral ground and respect upon the world stage is going to impact this. And so they will seriously consider how leaving in place such a reversal of 30 years of American foreign policy would play out. And of course, the impact of reversing the reversal of U.S. relations with its oldest ally Morocco is bound to play a part of that. So I expect that the last factor will mean that a direct and outright reversal is probably not on the cards. Instead, what may happen is not an overt walking back of the new policy, but a more subtle, perhaps inaction, essentially letting the focus on that part of it fade. And I think more of a focus on support of Morocco's autonomy plan, which is supported by the rest of United Nations members, including our allies such as France. And it's consistent with the U.S.'s prior position before, you know, for the last 30 odd years. So I expect that there will be a continued focus on achieving a negotiated resolution to the problem.
Some experts say that the new U.S. administration also is well aware that reversing the Trump brokered decision on the Sahara question would decisively endanger the strong ties between Morocco's armed forces and the U.S. military. What's your take on that?
I don't think that there's much of a risk of a rift here, even if the policy were reversed. And as I said, I don't think that's going to happen, at least not overtly. Morocco has benefited greatly from the relationship of the two militaries over the years with joint military exercises. There's an annual exercise that the U.S. comes every year to Morocco in March to help with. There's training, there are other programs. And I think that if a rift were to develop between the two militaries based on a political policy consideration, Morocco would definitely be the weaker for it. And as I just said, I don't envision, and at this point, an overt reversal of the policy.
That was Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. The African Union Disease Control Body said today it is not walking away from the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. It has shown a greatly reduced efficacy against the coronavirus variant dominant in South Africa. South Africa has paused the rollout of AstraZeneca shots to its health workers. In fact, it wants to sell or swap doses of the vaccine. According to a Reuters report, African countries are due to receive 100 million doses of the AstraZeneca shot this year under an AU vaccine plan. Africa CDC Director John Nkengasong said more has to be done to understand how the vaccine works against the more contagious 501Y.V2 variant first identified in South Africa late last year. Besides South Africa, six other African countries have reported the presence of the variant: Botswana, Comoros, Ghana, Kenya, Mozambique, and Zambia. Nkengasong says countries that have not reported the variant should go ahead with the AstraZeneca vaccine. He also added that the AU was in talks with Johnson & Johnson, the pharmaceutical giant, on the supply of more COVID vaccines. School exam results in Zimbabwe are demonstrating the impact of COVID-19 lockdowns and economic troubles on students, with 88 schools registering a 0% pass rate for seventh graders last year. Critics are up in arms with the government, especially after presidential spokesman George Charamba blamed teachers and students. Adigando gives us more on the story.
In-person classes have been halted and teachers have been striking for better pay and working conditions as years of economic downturn have eroded salaries. With government and unions digging in and no resolution in sight, students have been the biggest casualty, observers say. Charamba appeared to blame teachers for organizing strikes and the students themselves for not being diligent enough. The comments on Twitter have caused an uproar. The Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, PTUZ, says the poor performance is a no-brainer given the situation. The president of the union, Takawa Firajo, speaks on the issue.
Indeed, the poor performance was to be expected. the students did not complete the syllabus because they only learned for 1 year and only one term when they were in grade 7 because of the lockdown and closure of schools. Without the effort that teachers made, the performance could even have been very low.
Joe says government must shoulder the blame for the dismal results by not providing the education ministry with enough funds in the national budget and insisting that lessons could be delivered via radio and television. The majority of the country's citizens reside in rural areas and have little access to radios, let alone televisions. The government insists on blaming teachers for the strike, which stretched for the better part of last year, notwithstanding the national lockdown. Other public sector workers, including doctors and nurses, have also staged long stairway actions.
The causes lie squarely with the government. As professionals, we warned the government that the students were ill-prepared for examination, they had not completed the syllabi, they were facing a COVID pandemic, and going to school where there were no COVID abatement equipment. And furthermore, the government failed to pay teachers a living wage. That in itself also demotivated teachers and ensured that teachers were always scavenging for food.
Joe maintains that they advised government to postpone the exams till the situation improved. 10 of the worst performing schools are in Matabeleland. Dumisani Nkomo of Habakuk Trust, a Christian non-governmental organization working in the rural areas, says the test results must be viewed within the context of an education system that has been gradually degrading over a number of years.
What I would attribute this high failure rate to, especially in Matabeleland, is number one, most of the schools are poorly resourced. Kids have to walk long distances to go to schools because the schools are far apart, especially in Matabeleland North and South. So at times, by the time kids arrive where they learn, they'll be tired. Number two, there's the issue of poorly equipped schools, schools with no textbooks. Some of the schools cannot even be called schools because children learn outside under very difficult conditions. The teachers themselves are not well remunerated.
Nkomo and others maintain that the economy needs urgent attention as the system may be producing students who are functionally illiterate. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Ahead of the President's State of the Nation address today, the South African Chamber of Commerce is calling for urgent reforms to boost the economy. The Chamber published an index yesterday which shows business confidence in the country is at its worst level since 1985, when international economic sanctions were in place to help end oppressive apartheid laws. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to the economist who did the index, Richard Downing.
Downing says the average figure of 86.5 for 2020 was the lowest ever for the Business Confidence Index, which started in 1985 when there was lots of political unrest. He says the South African Chamber of Commerce would like to see urgent changes represented in the Finance Minister's budget later this month and today's address by President Cyril Ramaphosa.
The State of the Nation address must actually give direction, a broad direction to where we're going with the country as a whole, which goes beyond political party stuff.
Downing says South Africa already had recessionary conditions towards the end of 2019 into the first quarter of 2020. Then COVID came and lockdown restrictions worsened the situation.
First, restore the economy to some extent and to make sure that we'll be able to recover. So that is the first thing on the agenda. Then, of course, the second one will be address some structural issues, and especially in terms of your fiscal situation, where we actually move it towards a fiscal cliff. Public debt is getting out of hand. Your public sector institutions is not performing well. We know how the Eskom that provides power to the South African economy is actually battling, in terms of load shedding that we have frequently. And then there's a lot of hearings in terms of state capture and corruption that took place, and it's still continuing.
Downing says government must focus on creating policies that attract investors who can create jobs.
the role of the government in the economy is far too big to some extent. And it's quite evident with the small tax base, the limited tax base that we have in South Africa. It won't be able actually to finance all the things on the agenda or on the table. So it's a process of getting an economy that is actually able to provide employment to people in the first instance, and to have the private sector play a prominent role in creating that sort of situation, to actually sort of make sure that you can make inroads into the situation that we're facing at the moment. Because unemployment is at very high levels. It all depends on your definition, but in the broadest definition, it's above 40%, which is an unbearable situation.
Downing says the current over-collection of tax, which has surprised everyone, was a one-off.
It is more a random type of happening, but it helps to some extent. It might help you to finance this vaccine expenditure that they intend doing after having a mishap with the first batch of vaccines that they've ordered. So it's helpful, but it won't solve the problem. The problem is structural. It is not a seasonal or a random happening. It's an issue that you're on a trend that's not good as such. And although there has been a lot of noise about what to do, and I think Treasury is well aware of what to do, but it's politically very difficult to get some of these issues through.
This week, South Africa stopped the rollout of its first COVID vaccine from AstraZeneca after a local clinical trial found it offered only 22% efficacy against the coronavirus variant discovered at the end of last year. Considering the dire state of the economy, some analysts believe it's possible Ramaphosa will announce the extension of the Social Relief of Distress grant at a cost of about 3 billion rand per month. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
A new Human Rights Watch report chronicles how more than 20 African governments are using the COVID-19 pandemic to clamp down on freedom of the media. The reports find that Zimbabwe's government, long known for repressing dissent, is one of the worst offenders. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
A Human Rights Watch report chronicles how more than 20 African governments are using the COVID-19 pandemic to clamp down on freedom of the media. The report released on Thursday says officials in Zimbabwe are cracking down on journalists, political opponents, health workers and others who criticized the government's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Jerry Simpson is an associate director for Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch.
In Zimbabwe, we've documented a number of incidents over the last year, and our report references three of those. A journalist that was beaten at a checkpoint near a lockdown area. We documented how a journalist was detained for 9 weeks for his COVID reporting. That was between July and November at various stages last year. And finally, we've noted how Zimbabwe introduced the 2020 Public Health Order Act in March, which threatened up to 20 years in prison for fake news reporting on public health matters.
Samson Takawira is a journalist with an online media outlet in Zimbabwe called 263 Chat. He is one of two journalists arrested last year for interviewing three opposition activists who were reportedly tortured by state security agents.
Our arrest served as a reminder to all other journalists, all other media people, not to pursue the story, because obviously this was a ploy to silence the people. This was a ploy by government to hinder its citizens from knowing the truth, what really had transpired to these ladies. No wonder why, even their bail conditions, they were not supposed to speak to the media.
Elasto Mugwadi, the head of the government-affiliated Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, confirmed that his organization had received complaints about abuses raised in the HRW report.
There were a few complaints when these issues were being applied. The robust approach in enforcement by the police. So generally, I think excessive enforcement. This is a continuous process. We are also not stopping, monitoring. We are still carrying on.
Simpson of Human Rights Watch mentioned Uganda and Malawi as other countries where authorities have cracked down hard on journalists trying to cover the pandemic.
For example, in Uganda, where security forces killed at least 54 protesters and injured 45 in November, while citing COVID-19 regulations, saying that the rallies that they were attending were illegal. And in Malawi, just a few weeks ago, in January this year, at least 7 police officers assaulted a journalist in the capital with pipes and sticks for several minutes after he asked permission to photograph them, enforcing COVID-19 regulations.
Human Rights Watch wants the UN Human Rights Council meeting later this month to commission a new report focusing on states' compliance with their rights obligations in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, including the impact of restrictions on free speech and peaceful assembly. The UN Human Rights Council was not immediately available for comment on the HRW's report called COVID-19 Triggers Wave of Free Speech Abuse. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Malawi police say fresh attacks against albino people have left one person dead and a girl traumatized. The United Nations in Malawi on Wednesday called on the government to address the root causes of the attacks, which have killed over 170 albinos over the past 7 years. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Police records show that 2 people have been attacked within the past week in southern Malawi. The latest is an attack on a 12-year-old albino girl in Machinga district who narrowly survived abduction Tuesday night when the 2 unknown assailants broke into her bedroom. The assailants, police say, fled after girl's mother shouted for help. The incident came 3 days after police in Mangochi district arrested 3 people in connection to the death of a 26-year-old man, Saidi Faton Dayton, who went missing January 27. According to police, the attackers confirmed killing Dayton, but said his body was taken in a bag for sale by their accomplice, who is still at large. Boniface Massa is country director of Standing Voice Malawi, an international NGO on rights for people with albinism.
It's very emotional. I never expected that the attacks to the level of someone being killed will happen again. I'm aware there's been threats, but I never expected that in 2021 we will register a case of someone being killed. So it's really a shocking moment for me. As also a person with albinism, it brings me back all the memories of my brothers and sisters whom we have lost.
Albinos in Malawi have been facing attacks because of false beliefs that concoctions mixed with their body parts brings wealth and good luck. Statistics show that over 170 albinos have been killed since 2014, with others missing and graves exhumed. Malawi's government has tried various means to end these attacks. In 2019, it distributed mobile personal security alarms to the country's estimated 10,000 albinos. But Massa says the introduction of the security gadgets hasn't changed anything.
That's a very good, clear indicator of a failed system, because the program needs to be monitored, the program needs to be evaluated to see how successful it has been. But unfortunately, in the recent attacks that we have seen in Malawi, we haven't seen these alarms working.
In a statement released Wednesday, the United Nations called on Malawi's government to allocate adequate funds toward addressing the root causes of the attacks. Maria Jose Torres is UN Resident Coordinator for Malawi.
This is not just an isolated incident, and it is related to the causes that goes from harmful practice to poverty to exclusion, discrimination, and require a comprehensive approach. And this approach is embedded in the National Plan for Action on Persons Living with Albinism. So actually, the plan is there, and that is a matter of appropriate implementation.
Malawi's Minister of Gender and Social Welfare, Patricia Kariati, told reporters this week the government is disturbed with the renewed attacks. She said government has stepped up interventions to end the attacks, which include sensitization campaigns involving police, traditional and religious leaders. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.